So, tonight's talk is equanimity with car horn. Car alarm. I don't know why I keep saying car horn, car alarm. Equanimity with car alarm. So, equanimity or acceptance, sometimes in the States people call it Zen. Zen is actually the name of the Japanese branch of Buddhist practice. The word Zen actually means meditation in that practice. It doesn't mean the state of equanimity and acceptance and calm abiding. In the Buddha's time, the word was upekkha, U-P-E-K-K-H-A. And it's been translated in a number of ways. Sometimes people translate it as radical acceptance, sometimes as balance, sometimes as non-reactivity, sometimes as equanimity. It basically means a state of mind where anything can arise and we don't have to react. We can know what's going on, but we don't have to be pushed into activity, trying to get rid of the unpleasant, trying to control and obtain the pleasant. So we can experience something that's irritating and be with it rather than having it ruin our meditation or our peace of mind. We can be around really pleasant sensations without it distracting us and pulling us away from what we want to focus our attention on. So equanimity is very fundamentally about maintaining one's composure rather than being pushed around by the various changing perceptions and sensations and feelings and thoughts and feeling tones and all that are occurring at any given moment. In the Buddha's lists, equanimity plays a very, very important role. It's the last factor in the seven factors of awakening, and it's the fourth of the Brahma Viharas, the divine states of mind that are always skillful. The first three are metta, which basically means an unconditional friendliness or a kind greeting. And this state has a lot in common with equanimity. The second being compassion, caring for pain and suffering when we see it internally and externally. The third being appreciation. Appreciating when we or someone else is experiencing happiness rather than experiencing envy or jealousy or feeling that there's only so much happiness to go around. The fourth state, equanimity, upekkha, basically is that balancing attribute that allows us to not only be in life without being pushed around by life, but it's also that ability to engage with other people in a skillful way without overly attaching in our relationships and in our helpfulness and in our concern so that other people pull us around or that we get dragged away from our inner peace. It's very much in this state, a form of knowing when to let go or to move on, which is just as much a part of a skillful relationship as compassion and kindness and appreciation. So, in essence, there's two very fundamental attributes of equanimity. The first is that it allows us to be in our lives maintaining a state of enough calm that when the inevitable ups and downs, good news, bad news, setbacks and opportunities arise, that we don't become overly excited or reactive, that we can pause, relax, breathe, and see over time what is our best cause of action. When we're reactive, we generally go into the survival first mode of thought. Just, you know, what's best for me right here and right now? Short-term solutions. We don't think in terms of long-term. We don't think in terms of what's the least harmful course of action. We don't think of what will be the most skillful for us in the long-term. We just think in right now, how can I get out of this or make the most of this when we're in reactivity? So reactivity is not skillful. And the beauty of equanimity is that it allows us to have enough peace and abiding that we can take our time and wait and decide skillfully on how we want to proceed in life. So it boils down to that, and it also boils down to a balancing factor in how we relate to or balance all the skillful attributes, our compassion, our kindness, our appreciation, our generosity, so that we don't get pulled or out of shape or over-attached. Now, focusing on the first part about maintaining a state of ease and serenity amidst the challenges and dramas of life, the Buddha gave a very famous teaching called the Eight Worldly Winds. And he said that very often people chase fame only to get blown back by when something we do receives no recognition whatsoever. Sometimes we chase approval from other people. We want to make other people like what we do. We want to get approval from our mother, our father, our loved one. We want other people to like and see and recognize us. And when we chase approval, inevitably we'll then at times get blown back by disapproval. If we chase pleasure, of course pain will arise as well. If we chase monetary gain or material gain to feel good, will inevitably experience times of loss, of not having enough. Now, some people teach this entirely as an external rule, that, you know, when there's right, there's left, when there's up, there's down, if you chase pleasure, you're going to experience pain. And there's a truth to that. We all know that the more we focus on getting approval from others, the more we experience and the more disapproval hurts. On the other hand, if we really don't care, if we get to a place in our lives when we follow our spiritual path and we have wise friends and we don't try to win approval from other people, then when we get disapproval, it doesn't suck quite as bad. The more we chase the positive state, the more the negative state fucking sucks, right? So if you chase after career success, then when there's no positive movement, when there's a setback, when there's a layoff or whatever, then it stings more. But if we have a state of enjoying but not attaching to our career endeavors, then where we don't become overly reactive and joy, yes, I did this well, this means I'm great, I'll live forever, this is awesome, then when we have the setbacks, which are inevitable, we won't be blown about. That's why they're called the Eight Worldly Winds. They blow us about. And at any time you chase anything external, the opposite will blow you back. It's a... It can be taught literally as an external faculty or just the result of attaching to externals for happiness. But there's another element to that, which I like to talk about because I'm a fucking geek, which is that all of these things have something very much in common when we're chasing or hunting down external pleasure. They all are based on the release of dopamine, yes, you knew it, in the midbrain. That's exactly right. You were right on it. And when we trigger the release of dopamine, dopamine is like a rush. It completely overwhelms our attention and makes us feel great. If you hook up, when rats are given unlimited amounts of dopamine, they keep hitting it again and again. Give me more, 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 more. And that's what we do. The problem is with dopamine that, A, it's the receptors become habituated and eventually desensitize. Whoa. That sucks, man. No. oh, shit. No. I don't know why I did that. That makes no sense. But so what this means is that the more we return habitually, addictively to external pleasures, the more these receptors eventually desensitize, and they need more and more stimuli to get the same buzz, the same happiness boost. There's a famous study that was mentioned in a couple of research papers where they gave, they tested businessmen, and they saw the amount of dopamine that was and baseline happiness shift that occurred after a successful deal. And to get the same amount of bump in baseline happiness, actually wasn't a study of dopamine, it was baseline happiness, they had the businessmen had to do a deal. The second deal had to be twice as much as the first to get the same lift. Doing the same deal, whether it was a $1 million deal, only got a fraction of the bump and feel good. And then the next deal had to be 3 times or 4 times as great. It was virtually an exponential curve in terms of how much stimuli was required to get the same feel good feeling. So chasing these external sources of happiness set ourselves up for disappointment, because as a model for feeling good about life, they're unsustainable. The more we turn towards pleasing other people or chasing after short-term sensual pleasure, such as, you know, the stuffing, the you know, chasing sex, whatever, the career advancement, all that stuff. These things can be wonderful if we don't chase them. If we focus on the joy of what we do and we enjoy the results, then we can sustain that model. But when we chase after something, then we set ourselves up. For example, if I become addicted to my iced coffee in the morning, which I am. It sucks when I forget to make it, or whenever I travel in any country in Europe, because the fuckers don't have it. They don't know what it means. You can sit and say, just fucking put some fucking ice in the fucking coffee. I'll get behind the fucking register. I'll do it for you. I'll show you what it looks like. And that's suffering, because it's not always available. If we become addicted to, you know, I love riding my bike. It's one of the ways I get a lot of exercise. But there are times in the year where it just kind of sucks riding the bike. And if that's my only source of happiness. In fact, if that's a dominant source of happiness, then I'm going to be kind of screwed. Because to get the same bump of dopamine and opiates that are released by exercise, you have to do more and more and more. So to have it, it will always give me a certain amount of joy and pleasure, but it will not be enough to give my life that real sense of purpose and deep meaning. So the Buddha suggested focusing our attention on the unconditional areas in life where we can develop a happiness that doesn't diminish, that doesn't we don't become habituated towards. He didn't know it at the time, but a lot of the meditations he taught have now been studied, and it turns out the pleasure of meditation doesn't happen with dopamine in the midbrain. It happens in the frontal lobe with oxytocin, and the good news about that is that it's replenishable. You can release it for the rest of your lives. Now, if you want to look at a graph of neurotransmitters showing the course of a relationship, which none of you would do, but if you did, and here's the relationship, right, over the course of, well, from you, I'll do it backwards, over the course of years, and this is the early relationship, and that's the spike of dopamine, because you're getting laid a lot, and you love it. Oh my God, this is great. Everything's wonderful. Everything's taken care of. Nothing fucked is ever going to happen again. I don't have to worry about my rent. I found Mr. and Mrs. Right. I love it. And look what happens, though, at month 3 when the dopamine starts flowing, because you've become habituated, and suddenly everything they say isn't wonderful anymore. Suddenly they're saying irritating things. So, which they were doing all along here, but when the dopamine was up here, you didn't give a fuck. They were like, whatever, I don't care. I'm having the time of my life. But then it's down here. Now, if that was all there was, we would never last, and nobody would ever be in a lasting relationship. But fortunately, there's this slow curve that's building, and that's called oxytocin, vasopressin as well. And that's subtle. It's not going to blow you away. You're not going to suddenly feel like, oh my God, I don't have to ever worry about my taxes, paying the bills, I don't have to worry about the rent. You'll still have those things in your awareness. But you will feel that you're on the right course in that domain of your life. And you'll feel a sense of happiness. And this oxytocin also is released in care and compassion and appreciation, and in being rewarding ourselves, and in developing gratitude. All of these things, all of these things don't have to, we don't have to worry about them diminishing. And this is where equanimity comes in. It's reminding ourselves that when we get caught up in the world, overbalanced by things that people say, overbalanced by overreactive to, I should say, bad news or information we didn't want to receive about our art or about our endeavors in our work life or whatever, we will not be completely suddenly dropped into a bottomless pit, because there will be sources of happiness. In other words, the reward circuits of oxytocin and a little bit of serotonin will still be there, not just in our meditation, but through our gratitude, through our appreciation, through our opening to life and experiencing it and cultivating a sense of spacious awareness. Just that in itself can make the mind not become bent out of shape and pushed around by the bad news that we receive. So in that sense, we're balancing. We're balancing by developing another source of happiness and inner ease. Another way that equanimity plays out, I said at the beginning, was with when we're engaged trying to be useful to other people, trying to be compassionate or helpful or involved and with other people. This can be in a 12-step domain where people are sponsees, or it can be a relationship, or it can be the relationship between a parent and a child, or of one friend and another. But there's a tendency when we try to be helpful, we try to be of service or of use, to over-attach and to suddenly be dragged around. The Buddha very much was in favor of compassion and kindness, but he said it had to be balanced. If we don't balance it with equanimity, this sense of knowing when to let go, this limit of knowing how much we can be involved with others, then we will simply wind up not being that useful in general. I'll give you an example. If there was a heart surgeon that could perform the only kind of surgery that he developed a new surgery that nobody else could do, and he could save potentially thousands of lives, we wouldn't want that heart surgeon to be so caught up in the first patient he saw, so enraptured in trying to save them, that he couldn't devote his attention to other people. We'd want him to know how much attention was appropriate to give. We'd want him to be kind and gentle while he was with that person, but wouldn't want him to become so over-involved with patient A that patient B through Z died as a result. So in our own lives, we can be useful and helpful, and we can benefit from connection with so many people. Yet for some reason, very often, we get caught up in one relationship that we try to fix or solve. The one person that we want to like us who's not responding positively. We get attached to one relationship, and we lose interest in all the people that are available and open and welcoming and there and who we can connect with and even experience a real deep understanding with. We keep going back to the same, dour relationship, or the one that's at this point not working. Sometimes it boils down to previous experiences in life. Sometimes we just have a history, and no matter how much we now want to be helpful, we're just the wrong person. Sometimes it could be that we just remind or are triggering something in that other person. They just can't get, or they just cannot receive from us what we're transmitting. They cannot be comfortable with us. They cannot open to what we're trying to achieve. Equanimity is knowing when it's time to move on, so that we can continue to expend our efforts wisely. If I'm so caught up in trying to fix the wrong person, I'll never get around to being open and connected with the other people that are in life. Another example is when I was younger, I was very involved in some activist causes, and one of them was Citizens in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. It was called CISPIS. And it seemed that whenever we would be involved in a project to raise money or do anything positive, then inevitably, right afterwards, we get news that some death squad had killed more people. And if the attachment got too great, if I was over-attached to the result, all the joy of doing something of benefit to others would have been wiped away. So equanimity is also knowing when to let go of the results. knowing that to put the focus on basically the role of what we can control, which is our participation, but letting go of whether the end results are what we want. If you've ever done any activism, you know what I mean. The progress is really depressingly slow. And sometimes there's setbacks. And the only way we can maintain any semblance of peace while being engaged is knowing when to let go. So that's very much a factor, too, of equanimity. So how do we develop this state of balance and this state of composure? Well, the first is what we did in the meditation, which is the spacious mind. In other words, just like we did in the meditation when we were focusing on the car horn, we also had enough awareness on the breath and the body that the car horn, if we were doing that meditation with enough diligence, the car horn, even though it's irritating, it wouldn't force us to have a miserable meditation. We can still work with relaxing the body where resistance to the car horn shows up in the body. We can still relax the breath so that we're at ease with the car horn. This is how we develop equanimity even when there's bad news in life. When somebody insults us, when somebody breaks up with us, when somebody rejects us, when somebody abandons us, when somebody doesn't show up for us. We have enough attention on other parts of other sensations that are occurring right now. Well, I still can focus on this. I can focus on my creativity. I can focus on relaxing the body. I can focus on relaxing the breath. I can focus on so many other things that we keep the mind from being swallowed up by the bad news, the setback. The Buddha had a word called tamayata, which means when bad news or good news happens, the mind tends to shrink to the very size of that information, and it's aware of nothing else. He said we have a shrinking mind, tamayata. Whenever something out of the ordinary, good or bad, dramatic, happens, the mind just collapses, and it's only aware of that one thing. And if that's the way we allow the mind to be, we can be pushed around and completely made miserable by life. Atamayata is the state of not allowing the mind to shrink around anything, keeping the mind spacious, keeping other things in our awareness. So if we do that, no matter what's coming or what news you get, just remember, first, find where the resistance is. Breathe into it, relax the breath, relax the body. Then focus on what else is available right now that you can pay attention to. We're not pushing away the bad news, but we're not allowing the mind to collapse around it. I hope that makes sense. The second factor we can do is called greeting or embracing. And this is a variation of metta, which is we simply practice saying welcome as a matter of habit to anything that we perceive. I was on a spiritual trip with a bunch of other spiritual practitioners from different areas. And there was a group of people that were just thoroughly obnoxious. And everybody else was wonderful, but this group was just awful. And it turned out that they were situated in we were staying in these little huts, and they were right next to my hut. And the first morning I just woke up and I was like, "You nut! You!" And the entire body, you know, and everything went into resistance. And when you're in resistance, there's no possibility of good news happening. You won't allow it. It's like waking up on the wrong side of the bed, or, you know, after somebody, you know, after, you know, you get dumped in a relationship, and it's just, And so the next day I practiced just saying welcome. just this. When we say just this, what it means is this right here. This is what I'm working with, and I'm glad because there's nothing else I can be working with right now. And trying to go somewhere else that's not real is not the solution. Turning and greeting and opening to something doesn't mean I agree with the fact that, given my choice, I wouldn't choose to have these people here. I'm not saying that these are, great people. But this is what I'm working with. These are the people right next to me. These are the people I have to practice opening to. I get into this, develop this habit of saying welcome to my experience, it immediately softens all the habitual resistance that I've accumulated previously to these people or these perceptions or this events. It was one person that I worked with for a very long time who was always very, very difficult, and people would avoid this person like the plague. And the person once came to my office and they knocked, and I immediately caught myself saying, "What do you want?" And I noticed the tone of voice, and I noticed that nothing, in fact, was happening. And I just said, "Welcome," in my mind, "Welcome, welcome." And then I breathed and relaxed, and the entire conversation went just wonderfully. And from that point on, when I practiced that, every conversation, every interaction we had went perfectly well. I realized that so much of the conflict that would arise simply because of carrying the resistance and the expectation and the pushing away. So turning the mind, even though it sounds artificial, by just saying welcome, is a wonderful practice in developing equanimity. Another practice the Buddha talked about throughout the canon is finally the practice of balancing or cultivating balancing thoughts. So, for instance, if I'm caught up, this is an example that I'm starting with an example that I never do, but it's a good example. The example of when you're caught up in lust. Oh, that person's really attractive. Wow. Not that I ever think those thoughts, but if I did. The Buddha said if you're really caught up with lust and it's very much distracting and it's for somebody that, is unavailable, he talked about cultivate the opposite, which is focus on the repellent aspects of what's inside of their body. So visualize their liver. Is their liver so beautiful or attractive or handsome or whatever? There was a famous story of Ajahn Chah with his new monk, and the new monk was very much in love with his ex-girlfriend and was, worrying what she was doing and so in love with her. And Ajahn Chah said, it's so wonderful how deeply you love this woman. And the monk said, "Yes, I love her so much." And then the Chah said, "I want you to close your eyes." And the monk did. He said, "I want you to visualize her colon." And the shit in her colon. And tell me how much you love the shit in her colon. And of course that worked. Now, I don't ever do that. But I do a lot of balancing meditations. When I'm caught up in financial insecurity, I often think about all the positive, wonderful things that I've developed in my life and like the sources of happiness that I have that have absolutely nothing to do with money. When I'm caught up in any kind of reactivity, I focus on, this is not where lasting happiness is going to be for me anyway. When I was we've been fortunate enough to have a lot of media come and follow us, and a couple of times you get interviewed by and you picture, well, okay, this is good news. This is going to bring people to the Sangha. And then invariably, I read the article the next day or see the video and it'd be like, oh my God, I look like a fucking lunatic. And, you know, and of course, you know, or and even the times when it turned out pretty well, then you look down, and because it's the internet, you know you shouldn't do it, but your eyes wander down to the comments. And the comment says, who is this bald freak? This tattooed, you know, idiot. And why does he think he has any... I'm like, but, you know. I've been practicing for almost 40 years and I've studied with monks and have had teachers for 20 years. That's my mind. Blah, blah, blah. And then I would counteract it with, wait, this was never going to bring, this was always going to have a negative side. But the one thing that I can always feel good about is that I showed up and I experienced it. And regardless of how it's received, that I was present, I had an experience, I showed up for it, I opened to it, I answered the questions, and that I can feel good about. So that's a balancing thought. Always going back to what is my role that I can feel good about, rather than how is it being received or taken or twisted or changed or manipulated out in the world. So that's tonight's talk on equanimity. I hope that there was enough worth pondering. I'm going to turn off the...